At first sight, it may not be obvious why Christianity has any relevance for a course offering an integrated history of Greece and Rome. The fact is, however, like so many other features we've been looking at, Christianity was in many ways a Greco-Roman construct, by which I mean that it would not have assumed the particular character that it did, nor indeed have become a world religion, were it not for the fact that it took root in the Greco-Roman world. Had Jesus, for instance, been a barbarian living in, say, Britannia or Germania, it's extremely doubtful whether he would have become the posthumous founder of a world religion. I don't mean to deny the importance of his Jewish roots or his Jewish identity, but these alone would not have been sufficient to forge a new religion with universal appeal. Religious universalism was in the air. We see this in the case of the worship that was paid to the Roman emperor, in the cult of Isis that spread throughout the Greek-speaking East, and in the worship of the half-Hellenized god Mithras that gained popularity among those serving in the Roman army in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. The fact is that Greco-Roman culture conspired, so to speak, albeit unconsciously, to allow Christianity to take root, gain momentum, and ultimately oust its rivals. So, first, what did the Greeks contribute to Christianity? The most obvious point is that Greek was the language in which the early Christians spread their message throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. When Alexander the Great died in 323 BC after bringing Judea into the orbit of Greek culture, Judea came under the rule of the Seleucid monarchs. As a result, the majority of the educated Jewish population, just like most educated people living in the Eastern Mediterranean, were Hellenized and spoke Koine, the common dialectal form of Greek throughout the Hellenistic world. Koine was the language spoken by the Jewish elite, not only in Jerusalem, but also throughout the Jewish diaspora. And that's why the Hebrew Bible was translated from Hebrew into Greek in Alexandria sometime between the 3rd century BC and the beginning of the Christian era, the so-called Septuagint. Hence the Greek words Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy for the first books of the Hebrew Bible. And it's also why the New Testament was written in Greek. Incidentally, the oldest surviving fragment of a gospel was found in the sands of Egypt. It's the Gospel of St. John, and it's probably dated to the 2nd century AD. We should also note, however, that by the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, the Bible was being translated into a number of other languages for non-Greek-speaking Christians, including Coptic, Syriac, and Latin. So, the fact that Greek became the language of the New Testament meant that the early Christians were able to communicate with and engage in dialogue with the cultured elite throughout the Mediterranean. An early instance involves St. Paul's visit to Athens. The author of Acts reports that St. Paul addressed a group of Epicureans and Stoics from beside the Areopagus, a low rock overlooked by the Acropolis. Evidently, his arrival must have created quite a stir for representatives of these two philosophical schools to come and hear what he had to say. Having previously taken note of an altar in the Agora with an inscription to the unknown God, he announced to them that the unknown God was in fact Jesus, citing the now famous verse, "In him we live and move and have our being," which is sometimes attributed to a Greek sage of the 6th century BC, known as Epimenides of Crete. So Paul was in fact arguing with the philosophers on their own terms. As matters turned out, they were underwhelmed by his claims. "We'll hear of this again later," was their comment. "Don't call us, we'll call you," in other words. There's also a totally fortuitous way in which the Greek language may have influenced Christian thinking. It has to do with the allusion to the virgin conception in St. Matthew's Gospel, a central tenet of Christian doctrine. The author of St. Matthew derived this idea from a verse in Isaiah, which he cited as a proof text. The verse reads in the English translation, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son." This is an accurate translation of the Greek word parthenos that appears in the Septuagint. The problem is that parthenos itself is an inaccurate translation of the Hebrew word that occurs in Isaiah, alma, which means a young woman, but not necessarily a virgin. Geza Vermes has suggested that if the author of Matthew had been working from the Hebrew directly, the doctrine of the virgin conception would not have established itself. I now want to talk about Christianity's intellectual debt to the Greeks. I can't actually prove that the early Christians directly borrowed from the Greeks, but it's clear they would have been susceptible to Greek ideas that were in the air, relating to philosophy, religion, literary style. There are three main areas of Christian belief in which we can detect the influence of Greek philosophy upon Christianity. First, the belief in an entity called the soul. As early as the 6th century BC, Greek philosophers had been speculating on the nature of the soul. Probably the most famous of these was Pythagoras of Samos, roughly 530 BC, who taught that the soul transmigrated into animals and even into plants. It was Plato, however, who in the 4th century BC first sought to demonstrate by reasoned argument, number one, that the soul is immortal, number two, that vice is a disease of the soul, and number three, that the soul has the capability of apprehending the divine. Second, the belief that divine retribution is meted out to the wicked in the next world. This too was a view that had been around for a very long time. We already find traces of it in Homer, as in the fate of Tantalus, who must endure eternal punishment because he had grossly offended the gods. Much later, we see the same belief in an elaborated form, now universally applied to all the dead, in Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, set in Hades. Neither the belief in the soul nor the belief in divine retribution was original to Greek thinking, however. They were already present both in Egypt and in Mesopotamia in the 3rd millennium BC, but it was primarily through the filter of Greek thought that they had become commonplace throughout the Mediterranean at the beginning of the Christian era. Third, the belief in a supreme being or organizing principle. A noteworthy instance in the New Testament is the opening verses of St. John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This, too, shows the influence of popular Platonism, though, and this is important to note, there is no actual evidence that the author of John was directly familiar with the works of Plato. The Gospel of John was written near the close of the 1st century AD. In the 2nd and 3rd centuries, Greek philosophy was incorporated into the creation of Christian theology through direct and sustained engagement with classical texts. Many of the pioneers of this movement were based in Alexandria, which in the 3rd century became a center for Christianity. Alexandria now established itself as the home of theological inquiry, which breathed new life into its long-standing intellectual tradition. One of the most prominent of these pioneers was Clemens, roughly 150 to 211, who made it his task to insert Christian teaching into pagan forms of expression. His writings are liberally peppered with quotations from Greek authors such as Homer, the tragedians, and Plato, though scholars have surmised that he didn't actually read the works in full, but culled the quotations from anthologies. I next want to say something about a possible literary borrowing from Plato. Greg Sterling has argued that the author of St. Luke's Gospel deliberately departed from the description of Jesus' death that we find in Mark and presented a variant much closer to the description of Socrates' death that we find in Plato's dialogue, The Phaedo. He points out that in Mark, Jesus gives a cry of desolation from the cross in Aramaic, my God, why have you abandoned me? Which is a citation from Psalm 22. In Luke, however, Jesus says, Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit, a citation from Psalm 31. Sterling believes that the author changed the citation in order to eliminate, I quote, any hint of an emotional struggle within Jesus, just as Plato eliminated any hint of a struggle in his description of Socrates' death. Though there's no evidence that the author of Luke had directly read the Phaedo, it's entirely possible that he was familiar with the tradition of Socrates' death. He further claims that the writers of the Book of Maccabees previously adopted the exemplum of Socrates' death in their description of Jewish martyrologies, a particularly interesting suggestion, given the fact that the subject of this work is the throwing off of Hellenic influence. One such death involves a high-placed scribe called Eleazar, who, rather than be forced to eat pork, I quote, welcomed death with honour rather than life with pollution, and who thus went to the rack of his own accord. We should note, too, that Jesus' crucifixion was highly problematic for the early church. Crucifixion represented a very ignominious form of execution, since the Romans reserved it for slaves and insurgents. By conflating Jesus' death with that of Socrates, the paradigmatic pagan martyr, the author of Luke was able to dignify crucifixion and lend it a philosophic colouring, which it would otherwise have lacked. There's another very different instance of literary borrowing that I want to mention. Scholars have long since noted that both the Gospels, and more particularly the Acts of St. Paul, owe a debt to the Greek novel. Both use similarly literary motifs, such as hardship endured, wanderings undertaken, torture survived, and faith or fidelity preserved. But whereas the Greek novel ends happily in marriage, the Christian texts end in martyrdom, although we might construe martyrdom as a marriage of the soul to the divine. Richard Rutherford is of the opinion that the Greek novel and the Christian texts, I quote, recognizably cater for some of the same tastes. In other words, they were both tailored to the expectations of the novel reading public. Yet another influence is Greek oratory. We observe its workings in the Sermon on the Mount, most notably in its striking use of paradox. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, for instance. Though we don't know how the author, or more tantalizingly, how Jesus himself might have come by a knowledge of Greek oratorical technique, it's conceivable that there were handbooks on the subject circulating in Judea at the time. So far, I've talked about the influence of philosophy and literature, and I now want to turn to correspondences between the polytheistic and Christian mindset. Take the Greek mystery religions, which promised initiates a blessed hereafter. The most important of these, the Eleusinian Mysteries, was based on the myth of Persephone, the daughter of the goddess Demeter, who was abducted by Hades, lord of the underworld, who then took her down to the underworld to be his wife. Demeter's grief was such that she neglected her role as goddess of the harvest, and a famine spread over the entire earth. Eventually, a compromise was reached, and Persephone was allowed to return to her mother for 8 months of the year, during which the earth revives, consonant with Demeter's joy. So, death and resurrection lie at the heart of the myth, and it may well be that there are other borrowings. Demeter, the grieving mother of Persephone, anticipates the Mater Dolorosa, the grieving mother of Christ, an important figure in early Christianity. I would also point out that the mystery religions, like Christianity, appeal to all social strata from emperors downwards. The only persons not eligible for initiation were non-Greek speakers and murderers. So the mystery religions prepared people psychologically for the arrival of Christianity by holding out the promise of salvation that had nothing to do with social rank. Another Greek cult with connections to Christianity is that of the healing god Asclepius. Asclepius, before being accorded divine status, was a human healer, so gifted that he was capable of restoring the dead to life. He was thus both accessible to the sick and sympathetic to the human condition. Inscriptions found at healing sanctuaries bear out the claim that he was believed capable, like Jesus, of performing miraculous cures. It's also worth noting that the early Christians regarded both the cult of Asclepius and the Eleusinian Mysteries as rivals to Christianity, from the fact that they engraved graffiti at their sites. Tertullian, a prolific Christian writer of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, poured ridicule on the Eleusinian mysteries. He claimed that the ceremony of initiation culminated in the revelation of a naked male member. There was probably as much truth to this as if an opponent of Christianity were to complain that its ceremonies culminated in the devouring of Christ's flesh and blood. Tertullian is an interesting figure. He was probably the very first Christian theologian to write in Latin. Incidentally, it wasn't until the 2nd century AD that portions of the Bible began to be translated into Latin, as I'll talk about later. Lastly, there was nothing new in the belief that a human being could be divine. Human beings had been receiving divine honours in the Greek world in their lifetimes from the beginning of the 4th century BC onwards, the first example being Lysander, a Spartan admiral who was so honoured by the people of Samos. Next, I want to turn to the Roman contribution to early Christianity, a contribution that occurred in part precisely because of the actions that the Romans took to stamp it out. There are three ways in which the Roman Empire assisted the spread of Christianity: through emperor worship, by its communications network, and, paradoxically, through persecution. Let me say at the beginning that Jesus' mission itself was of no interest to the Roman authorities. It was only when Jesus incurred the wrath of the Jewish high priesthood that he became an irritation to the Roman prefect of Judea, Pontius Pilate. Pilate, no doubt, had to deal with lots of self-professed messiahs on a regular basis, and in his eyes, there would have been little, if anything, to distinguish Jesus from all the rest. So first, emperor cult. We've already talked about this phenomenon in some detail, so all I want to say here is that the fact that the Roman Empire was already habituated to the worship of an individual who claimed a central role in the religion of the entire empire helped to prepare its subjects for the spread of a monotheistic religion. Henotheism, the belief that one god exercises superior powers, was, moreover, deeply ingrained in both Greek and Roman religion. Both Zeus and Jupiter exercise a power greater than any other god. Second, when Paul began his missionary journeys across the Eastern Mediterranean, he was greatly assisted by the fact that the Roman Empire permitted freedom of movement, upheld at most times the principle of religious tolerance, and provided safeguards to all its citizens. True, he comes in for some harsh treatment, but never at the hands of the Romans, and he even exploited those safeguards to further his cause. I'm referring to an incident reported by the author of Acts that occurred in Philippi in northern Greece when Paul and his companion Silas were arrested for disturbing the peace. When they were released after spending a night in prison, Paul started to kick up a fuss, declaring, "They, i.e. the magistrates, have had us beaten in public and put us in prison without giving us a trial, even though we're Roman citizens." At this, we're told, the magistrates, who I think it's safe to assume were non-citizens themselves, became afraid. So they came to the jail and they apologized to the two men. The implication from this seems to be that Paul had deliberately concealed his identity to cause a public stir and thus draw attention to his mission, a classic instance of self-promotion. It was, in fact, in the Greek-speaking East that the fledgling religion first began to take on an ecumenical aspect. It was in Antioch, in about 36, that the term Christianoi was first used to identify adherents of Christ, as we also learn from Acts. We should also note that it was the Roman road system that permitted the dissemination of Paul's letters to the empire's capital in Rome, to the flourishing Roman colony at Corinth, to the province of Galatia in central Turkey, to Ephesus, the capital of the province of Asia, to Philippi in eastern Macedonia, and so on. Once Christianity arrived in Rome, it became, to put it crudely, a veritable showstopper. And this is where I come to the third way in which Rome contributed, in the unforeseen consequences that followed its attempt to crush the Christian movement. The first recorded instance of Christian persecution took place under the Emperor Nero in AD 64. Nero falsely accused the Christians of setting fire to Rome in order to scotch the widely held rumor that he was in fact responsible. Or so the story goes. Christian men and women were thrown to the wild beasts in the Colosseum, where they went willingly and bravely to their deaths before a hostile crowd that numbered around 60,000, or so we're told. In fact, there are no contemporary records of any Christians being put to death in the Colosseum, as Beard and Henderson note. In fact, the earliest reports of martyrdoms taking place there are by Christian writers of the 5th century AD. Over the course of the next century, the Christians underwent only sporadic persecution. For an interesting insight into imperial policy towards the Christians in the early 2nd century, we have correspondence between the Emperor Trajan and Pliny the Younger, governor of Bithynia and Pontus, southern shore of the Black Sea, dating to the year 112. Pliny tells the emperor that he's been receiving anonymous denunciations against Christians, and he doesn't know what to do. Should he treat the young and the old alike? If the Christians repent, should they be pardoned? And so on. Trajan was not at all favorable to Christianity, but his response is eminently reasonable and fair. Christians should not be sought out. If proven guilty, they are to be punished, but if they repent, they should go unpunished. And he instructs Pliny not to take action on the basis of anonymous accusations. In other words, Trajan advocated what we would call today a don't ask, don't tell policy. We see this attitude of tolerance to the new religion reflected also in Christian writers of the same period, who rarely lodge any complaints against the Romans. The exception is the author of the Revelation of St. John, who is deeply hostile to Rome's power and who ends with a prediction of the destruction of Babylon, for Babylon, read Rome, and of the establishment of a new Jerusalem on earth. Quite possibly, the author was influenced by Rome's brutal crushing of the Jewish revolt and destruction of Jerusalem. In the later 2nd and 3rd centuries, complaints against Rome by Christian writers would increasingly gather in force and intensity as the church's universalist mission came to challenge Rome's claims to government. The only officially condoned persecution in the 2nd century was instigated by Marcus Aurelius, whom we think of, ironically, as one of the five good emperors. It resulted in the torture and execution of 48 Christians at Lyon and Vienne in France in 177. He did so at a time when the empire was beginning to experience incursions from barbarian tribes, so the Christians, as under Nero, were again a convenient scapegoat. The first large-scale persecution of Christians occurred in 249 when the Emperor Decius ordered a dies imperii, that's to say, a general supplication to the gods for the safety and victory of the emperor by everyone living in the empire. Jews, it seems, were exempted from acknowledging the divinity of the emperor, as they had been since the time of Augustus. Decius was responding to mounting political instability and threats to the security of the empire. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Roman world, including Christians, complied. The authorities were very clever. They didn't demand that the Christians give up their religion. They simply required them to pay their respects to the gods on whom the welfare of the state depended, and to take an oath to the effect afterwards. The church very nearly went under at this time. More persecution followed under Valerian in 257 and 258. Once again, it was the result of threats to Rome's security, occasioned by a series of military defeats that prompted the persecutions. It was the Emperor Gallienus who, in 260, finally ordered a halt to the persecution. He did so because he got cold feet. Both Decius and Valerian had been killed fighting against Rome's enemies, and this seems to have been sufficient to unnerve him. Half a century later, when Diocletian instituted a further persecution, first in 302 and then again in 304, it failed utterly. The edict of 304 sanctioned the killing of all Christians who refused to sacrifice to the gods. Its failure is all the more remarkable in view of the fact that this was the most sustained persecution of the Christians ever mounted. The climate of opinion had changed. In 250, Christianity had still been largely an urban movement. By the beginning of the 4th century, and probably earlier, The Gospels were being preached in every corner of the Roman Empire, and it was spreading throughout the countryside as well, notably in Egypt, which was the birthplace of the monastic movement. Diocletian's edict continued in force till 311, when the dying Emperor Galerius issued an edict of toleration, his deathbed surrender, as Philip Rousseau aptly puts it. 2 years later, in 313, Constantine, the emperor in the west, and Licinius, the emperor in the east, held a conference at Milan. I'll talk about the division of the empire into two halves in a later lecture. They agreed to a compromise between Licinius's pro-pagan view and Constantine's pro-Christian view. The so-called Edict of Milan affirmed religious freedom throughout the empire. There can be no doubt that persecution helped to galvanize the Christian community. The Romans thought they were demonstrating their superiority over the Christians by sending them to their deaths. Instead, they found themselves involved in a war of propaganda, which the Christians went on to win hands down. Martyrdom provided the Christians with a stage, quite literally, upon which to proclaim the indestructibility of their faith. Once martyrdom had occurred, it served as an inducement to other Christians to follow suit, since the description of the martyr's death in all its edifying details were read out in church. Imperial policy was not, of course, the only threat that Christians faced. More insidious and more unpredictable were the persecutions organized by unruly mobs looking for a scapegoat in time of trouble, when the crops failed, when an epidemic broke out, and so on. Christianity's debt to Greece derived in part from the general religious mindset of the Greek East, and in part from the intellectual engagement with the ideas and literary forms of pagan classicism. Correspondingly, if Jesus had not come into conflict with Pontius Pilate, and if the early Christians had not made themselves so objectionable to the Emperor Nero, Christianity might have disappeared without trace, since it was the crucifixion of their leader and the martyrdom of his followers, which chiefly differentiated the Jesus movement from a host of other competing messianic religious movements. And it was the general atmosphere of tolerance that prevailed throughout the Roman Empire, punctuated by outbursts of persecution, which provided the fuel to galvanize the Christian community. Shortly after the Edict of Milan had been passed, Christianity went on to the offensive and pagans became the victims of persecution. This did not bring paganism's quick demise, however. It's all too easy to think that once Constantine came to the throne, it was all over for paganism. This was far from being the case. Indeed, there is evidence of pagan worship as late as the 6th and 7th centuries. It was, in fact, in the Greek-speaking East, not in the Latin-speaking West, that resistance to the advance of Christianity was fiercest, just as it was in the Greek-speaking East, where Christianity first took root. In Aphrodisias, the city of Aphrodite in southwest Turkey, pagans remained prominent in civic life as late as the 6th century. In fact, there is no attestation of any Christian presence in the city until AD 325. A great deal of pagan sculpture was defaced and mutilated, and the temple of Aphrodite was converted into a Christian basilica, the same fate accorded to the Parthenon in Athens. And then, at some point, we don't exactly know when, but possibly in the 7th century, Aphrodisias was renamed Stauropolis, modern Stavropolis, meaning the city of the cross. Evidence in the form of inscriptions indicates that the progress of Christianity was in Aphrodisias and other pagan centers both slow and labored. It wasn't until 384 that Jerome completed his translation of the Gospels from the Greek, the so-called Vulgate version. Until then, there had been no authoritative translation in Latin. He later went on to translate the Hebrew Bible. Jerome had a famous dream, or nightmare, in which he was accused of being a follower of Cicero, and therefore a pagan, and not a Christian. And after it, he gave up reading pagan works for a time. His dream is symptomatic of the tension between Christianity and pagan literature that many Christians of this period felt. As J.H.D. Scarfield has pointed out, perhaps more than any other of the Latin fathers, Jerome can be seen as a man of the classical world who happened to be a Christian. Arguably, the foremost centre of pagan worship in late antiquity was Athens, which held out against Christianity at least until the 6th century. And it is to an examination of that city's fortunes under Roman rule to which we turn in the next lecture.